Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, or good evening, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Michael Morris. Today we're going to be discussing gambling, demands for action from politicians by churches, and chaos across South Africa. Let's start off with this point on gambling. This is something that caught my eye, that we had someone posted this graphic in an internal discussion group. We have, and it's from Stats SA. It comes from the Consumer Price Index survey by Stats SA, and they found that gambling accounts for over half of all household spending on the category of recreation, sports, and culture. Gambling is 54.5% of household spending on recreation, sport, and culture. The next highest is gym fees, and then after that, dolls, toy cars, toy building bricks, dog food, cat food, that sort of thing, making up sort of around 6% for on gym fees, 5% on the various different types of toys. And I thought, you know, when you consider South Africa's economic position, that we are a country that is so indebted, even our middle class is you know, quite heavily indebted, so economically stressed. And then you see a figure like the fact that people are spending so much money on gambling, at least, you know, relative to the to other forms of entertainment. Michael, this to me speaks of a much deeper despair in South Africa. I think this, you know, for a lot of people, this represents maybe kind of hope. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I think it is very worrying. I mean, just to, you know, as an aside, we could perhaps draw some comfort from the fact that some fairly healthy items of spending are the next on the list. Gym fees, not too bad. Dog food, cat food, toy cars. As humans, I think that this is a recommendation. But no, in fact, you know, the difference between the next highest is 5.9% on gym fees to 54.5% on gambling. I mean, that's quite astonishing. And to me, it sort of speaks to a society that, you know, is now left to trusting Lady Luck as the source of its redemption. It's a kind of indication of a helpless sense of helplessness. It's almost like we've run out of all the rational ways to deal with our problems, and now the only thing that's left is to take a bet. You know, put some money on something and just hope, as you say. We're kind of trusting in hope. Trusting in luck, it's crazy, but it is. I think you're quite right. It reflects how we're feeling. We're feeling as if, you know, all the most sensible things are also all the most logical and practical things, the most obvious things that we need to do. We need to, you know, fix the way we do things. We need to do our jobs properly. We need to pay our taxes. We need to stop the criminals. We need to stop corruption. But in the absence of any of these things really being seen to be tackled sensibly by the people who we've elected to do it, people are beginning to think, well, that's not going to be the source of our redemption. We're turning to Lady Luck. So, yeah, I think it's a worrying thing. And quite apart from anything else, it's, you know, that's money which is presumably denied to, you know, umpteen, you know, not umpteen, but to millions of households are being, in a sense, deprived by this very sense of having to rely on superstition, essentially, on chance, instead of actually having a sense that if they took that money and invested it in a small way today and tomorrow and the next day, there would actually be a benefit. That seems to be eroding, and that is a terrible thing, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Look, I think some of this is technologically driven. I'm not sure what the figures are this for over the past couple of years, but I suspect there probably has been an increase, and I think some of that is driven by how easy and widespread online sports betting has become. I think some of this, as you say, is exactly because of those, you know, psychological, that sort of sense of just general despair. And the unfortunate thing is, you know, when you look at who is participating in a lot of this gambling, when you look at the profile and the advertising, who it's targeted at, of things like a lot of sports betting, when you look at who's standing in the queues for the lottery tickets a lot of the time, I mean, a lot of people buy them online nowadays, but or on their phones, but back when most people used to buy them in person, it ain't the CEOs. It ain't, yeah. it ain't the, the super rich. It's often people who are poor and are just hoping that, you know, this might be the way to get, you know, the hope that maybe something will change, that you'll either get, you know, a couple hundred bucks from a good place bet on your favorite team or win the lotto or something. As you say, that just seems to be what a lot of people are clinging to. And this is the, you know, a psychological symptom of our economic malaise.
Yeah, exactly. The sense that you're much more likely to gain some advantage from the society around you by taking a bet than you are by, you know, trusting in the service delivery or the proper schooling or, you know, anything working the way you should, a job becoming available tomorrow, an uptick in the economy that's going to give your family a chance to improve its position. You know, all of that is almost becomes this fantasy, this kind of fictional never land stuff. The real option is to take the bet. Yeah.
In terms of a policy response to this, I'm not the kind of person who likes banning things. I think banning things is often counterproductive. I think that, you know, if people are going to spend their money badly, that's their choice as adults. But when you see such an enormous sort of, wastage like this, and when you see how easy and how predatory some like sports betting stuff has become, I don't know, is there a policy response to this, or is this one of those things that we can fix by improving other parts of our society, you know, making sure that people grow up in stable families, making sure that people have jobs? What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think I mean I'm inclined to go with your latter position. I think, you know, good ideas often become corrupted when they are turned into impositions and burdens on people, and the unintended consequences flow so readily from that. It is a worry, you know. Can we just turn, not necessarily turn a blind eye to it, but think, you know, that somehow by some natural market process the gambling is going to recede? I'm not really sure. It is a huge risk, but I certainly wouldn't. There are very, very few authorities that I would trust with and producing a better result. I think is really,
yes.
And
that's always an important thing to remind. Is, you know, there's somebody, if you ban something like gambling, somebody has to enforce that. And do you really trust our state in particular to do that? And I certainly wouldn't. Okay. Well, let's move on to our next story. And this is something that I think is actually a really positive development. I've said on the show that I thought that a lot of churches in South Africa had, you know, not really been taking up the mantle of pushing for change in South Africa's communities, that since the end of apartheid, a lot of South Africa's church groups have either sort of gone along with the ANC, or they've kind of just sort of said, ugh, you know, when are we going to be very apolitical, which is fine to a certain degree. But then I think it's difficult to kind of join in the public conversation and condemn violence or this sort of thing in vague terms when you don't actually have some kind of solution. So with that in mind, in Nelson Mandela Bay, a group of churches consisting of Ebenezer International, the local diocese of the Anglican Church, the Catholic Church diocese in PE, the Ethiopian Episcopal Church, the Moderator Presbyterian Church, and a whole bunch of other churches and church organizations have been demanding better governance outcomes from the government in Nelson Mandela Bay. And to this effect, they recently had a meeting with the executive mayor, Lobishe from the ANC, and the premier of the province, Oscar Mayabuyane. And let's just say the meeting did not go well. The church leaders were very upset by this meeting. They said that essentially the politicians kind of tried to blame them for some of the problems, and even claimed that the roads were not potholed and the lines were painted, which the church leaders in a letter described as an outrageous claim. They went on to say, while the church is apolitical, we will be educating our congregants across all wards about the value of their vote and how to vote for people and parties that have the will to provide hope and economic growth to the metro. They also have written a letter to Cyril Ramaphosa and national government demanding urgent intervention and possibly placing Nelson Mandela Bay under some kind of administration by national government. Just parts in the letter: action needs to be taken now before the anger of the people boils over in the face of ongoing job losses. The impression of church leadership is that the premier and mayor do not understand the seriousness of the situation in the metro or choose to ignore the will of the people. It was a very interesting part to this discussion where they criticized specifically the ANC coalition that is governing the province. They said, quote, "The mayor and representatives from the coalition partners painted a false picture of stability within the governing coalition, consisting of the ANC, EFF, NA, which I think is the National Alliance, the AIC and PAC. Any stability is due to the ANC kowtowing to the demands of the smaller parties. What the voters of Nelson Mandela Bay in fact voted for is reflected in the government of national unity. 40% voted for the DA and 39% for the African National Congress. Together, that is 79% of the vote, giving the two parties a clear mandate to work together in the interests of citizens of the metro. Instead, leadership consists of tiny parties with negligible voter support headed by individuals who seem to put the agendas of themselves and their parties ahead of the plight of residents," the city's spiritual leader said in their letter. Michael, what do you make of this? This seems to me like a sort of fairly positive development, but also a reflection of what I think a lot of ordinary South Africans, how they view the government.
I think you're right. And, you know, it's quite striking to me that the very first name on this long list, as you indicated, of all the sort of major churches as well as many others, but the very first one is the Sovereign Council of Churches, chairperson of the Sovereign Council of Churches in the Nelson Mandela Bay Metro, Bishop Dr. William Leleki. Now, there would have been a time, I think, when the SACC would probably have been quite reluctant to publicly confront the government in this way, and I think that time has now changed, and this is very, very striking. Yet I absolutely agree with you. I can't help thinking back to the 1980s when that steadily gathering sort of coalition of really quite moderate voices in society coalesced very often around churches, people like Desmond Tutu, and became just a very powerful non-party political voice for ordinary people. There was that, enormous credit to F.W. de Klerk, as very newly elected president, to allow that big, big march in Cape Town. I don't know if you remember that in 1989. I think that's a week after the election. And all the sort of front rank of the marchers were clerics. From a variety of different denominations, who would perhaps ordinarily have had all kinds of theological disputes and other, but you know, united around a basic sort of public interest. And I think this is very much what we see in this letter. I think it is. I think it's very significant, and the fact that this sort of thing is happening so publicly. It's not, you know, a leaked letter. We've learned that the churches have, or, you know, all the sort of stuff. That these things usually begin that way, for more subtle private overtures being made. This is really a very candid statement, and especially those a few passages that you read out, sort of indicating the church's clear understanding of exactly what the political dynamics are, and stating it in that very plain way, and saying, "This is it. Get on with it." You know, this is where the people's interests lie. This is how they have spoken. The ball is in your court. So, yeah, I think a very important story.
I do think that the endorsement of the DA and ANC working together in the metro is a bit naive, in the sense that the parties have, you know, and this is the problem at national government as well, the parties have very different ideas on how to run the country. But I respect the sentiment, in the sense that this is just exactly that sort of desire of a lot of South Africans to just say, can we just focus on the problem, because we are running out of time and energy and money and life to actually, you know, deal with these problems. And so I think this is a very positive move. Do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I'd absolutely agree with you there that, you know, politics is very common for people to denigrate politicians and you know, to dismiss politics. Politics is really just a reflection of what we're all thinking, and all our contests for whatever it is we're contesting for, and it's healthy that it happens, that we've got a multi-party political fight on our hands. This is exactly as it should be. But I agree. It's that underlining what the priorities are. Get cracking on those. You know, find a way to work together. Find a way to get over all the pettier differences, and especially the considerations of your salaries and your perks and your fancy offices and so on. Think about how the people are living and really battling to make ends meet. It comes down to that.
In my view, politics tends to be healthiest when it is what it kind of always is, although often this is obfuscated by symbolic nonsense, but it's often really an argument about how to spend the public's money. Are we going to tax people more? Are we going to spend it enforcing this law, that law, all these sort of things? And when that conversation is completely sidetracked by mad ideological projects, racial nationalism, it's fighting over perks and seats, religious differences, whatever it is, you can put anything in there. Politics tends to produce bad results. I think this is a good thing, and we'll have to see whether this also has a big impact on the election, the local government elections next year.
Yeah.
Okay. Last one.
The point that you've underscored there, which I should have mentioned, but what we're talking about is these ideas percolating down to the people who actually really matters, the voters. The choices that they make in the ballot box. That's where you actually get the change. And I think gradually this idea is beginning to dawn on more and more South Africans. Lots of reasons for people to be slightly suspicious of parties they may be not all that familiar with, or ideas they're a little bit uncertain of. But I think steadily there's this idea, if you go to the ballot box and you get the right people and you put them in power, you're going to get a different kind of treatment. And I think, it's a very, very important point to underline. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, not at all. All right, let's move on to our last story. This is actually two separate stories that we're going to kind of put together. The first is the acting police minister, or the temporary police minister, or the police minister until such a future date as we figure out whether the other one is involved in crime or not. Feroz Khachalia has in the past criticized the cops for a Scorp, Skeet and Dorna approach to policing, basically criticizing the police for being sometimes too kind of violent and random and heavy-handed. He is, however, as he is now the police minister, been going around and meeting communities and things in Mfuleni in Cape Town. He recently went to a community forum where discussions about the incredible violence that has been taking place in that township on the edge of Cape Town were had. The Police Portfolio Committee chairperson Ian Cameron said in August, nearly 40 people were murdered in Mfuleni, a 62% increase compared to the same period last year. This is not a seasonal fluctuation. It's a systemic collapse. Local people in the area say that a gang who charmingly call themselves Boko Haram are basically fueling the violence, going around killing people, extorting people for money, that sort of thing. And Khachalia has obviously been moved by this because he said, quote, "We have to raid, we have to attack them. Yes, we must raid them in their homes." And he says that he pledges tougher policing among a surge of violent crime. He also says that there needs to be more done to make sure that the gangs are not technologically more advanced than the cops. Something he says he's going to tackle at a national level. Now, obviously, I completely agree with the police minister here. Like, obviously, more needs to be done here. The police do need to root out criminals and such. There needs to be a tough response. But at the same time, this is so typical of what always happens when we have this discussion about crime in South Africa. Firstly, how are you going to figure out who to raid if crime intelligence isn't working? Because it isn't. And secondly, we have this response so often to crime in South Africa where we just say, well, we must just make the punishments harsher. What does it matter if you never catch anyone, or if you don't follow through prosecutions once you actually arrest someone because, the evidence isn't collected, or the police don't give good testimony, or whatever it is? We need to do the basics right. We need to make sure the cops have a strong work ethic and culture of performance, and that non-performers are fired and the corrupt people are dug out and prosecuted. And we need proper resourcing for the cops. Neither of those things is the case right now. So saying, you know, we're going to shoot all the criminals is just words. It's not actually action. I don't know. Michael, am I being unfair here?
No, I think you're being absolutely right. it is those basic things. And a key part of it, I think, with policing, obviously, is accountability. It's not simply a question of creating yet another point of conflict, but now between cops and criminals in their homes. You know, we can all talk like this. We've got to, you know, put them in jail and let them rock to hell, or, you know, all these expressions that we've heard from ministers over the years. You know, let them rot in jail, I think was one of the ones that keeps cropping up. But it's not as simple as that. You know, we've got to have prosecutions are really the key thing. That means good cops, and there are plenty of them. They're being let down by the leadership who are just letting all the basics go to rack and ruin. Intelligence is a key thing. But, you know, to solve a crime, you need good cops, well-trained, accountable, understand exactly what their job is and do it dutifully, are protected by their superiors, doing that job, superiors rejecting political interference. It's all these kinds of things. And, you know, it's not going to happen overnight. I don't think we have, as you say, let so many of these basics just fall away. It's going to be a bit of a slog, which is a worry, because, you know, we never really know how much time we've got to stop ourselves from going from into a really bad situation. And policing is such a key part of it.
And on that point, let's talk about the second part of this story, which is in Westbury and Coronationville in Johannesburg, people have been protesting for a while for water, which keeps being cut off to their community, problems with the water infrastructure. Lots of suburbs in Joburg have had big problems with water recently, but there's been this new protest in Westbury and Coronationville. And I think, as my understanding was, that it started off fairly peaceful over the past couple of days, but things have unfortunately seemed to deteriorate today. There was outrage from people in the community after a video spread around of an old man, an 81-year-old man who got hit with a rubber bullet and was injured, which made a lot of people say that the police were aggravating the situation and making things worse. You had residents throwing rocks at cars and building sort of barricades and cardboard sheets and throwing beer bottles and stones at officers, nasty stuff. And during all this chaos, you then also had what looks to be basically either kind of unemployed young men and school kids, or maybe just school kids. It's not entirely clear. I've seen some videos from the events, you know, of school kids looting shops, looting local spaza shops, breaking into things, taking opportunity in the chaos to just, you know, steal stuff for themselves. And there's this video I've seen of a woman who lives in the community just despairing. This is our kids. They're not fighting for water. They're just taking things from shops. They beat this man. What are we, it's sort of despairing? What have we come to? And Michael, I don't know if you have anything to add on this one, except that it's just, this is just such a great example of what the police kind of are not doing right. We're not having proper management. People are angry because of all this dysfunction in government, you know, justifiably so. But then, you know, sort of chaos and disorder are the result. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's allied to all the other stories we've discussed. There's a certain kind of gambling element to this as well. There's an opportunity to get whatever it might be, a loaf of bread, a packet of chips, or a packet of cigarettes. I don't know what they're looting. You couldn't really see. I've looked at these horrifying videos, and always these videos are awful. People, you know, mobs just suddenly losing control and looting and pillaging and so on. It's a bit like a gamble. You know, maybe we get away with it. It's a bit like 2021. We saw that. If you're not going to buy the ticket, you might not get that flat screen TV, but, you know, you might also get caught, but maybe you get away with it. So, and things aren't working. The cops aren't even here. So maybe we are going to get away with it. So it's a gamble. You know, it's the same kind of thing. This terrible sense that people have lost faith in, or so easily, you know, shed the idea that it's worth being restrained, you know, behaving in a certain way, tomorrow is going to be better because there's a possibility of a job or a better prospect or, you know, the school result that's going to be beneficial. And these general conditions in which this kind of collective anger suddenly coalesces in a mob, and it has a sort of generic logic to it, and it's brutish, and it's you know, completely indifferent and heartless. And I think a point that we were chatting about before, maybe you have something to say about this, but it, also these conditions in which bad faith actors can easily exploit public sentiment and anger for their own ends and only make things worse. So yeah, it's very worrying, but it's allied exactly to, as you say, to the you know, policing or the absence of policing and all those basic things that people just either don't anymore or not afraid of anymore. There's no deterrent element here.
And the policing issue is not just some sort of tangential thing. These communities, Westbury, Coronationville in particular, have been really badly affected by gang violence over the past couple of years, shootings all the time. And there have been protests about that as well. But, you know, once again, the sort of response from government, in this case, the police, hasn't been really forthcoming. So, you know, this is what the police minister should be focusing on. Yes, you know, we must raid the homes of violent gangsters, but let's get the systems working so we can figure out exactly who those are and build the evidence and the cases and make sure that the police are actually doing their jobs properly. You know, emotional outrage feels good, but it doesn't actually solve problems, unfortunately. And, you know, just like this with school kids running around looting shops, that's not going to help anyone. It does seem to mostly be kids, by the way. Some of those videos you see that are actually like either still wearing their school uniforms or they've got like school backpacks on. And it's got an air of sort of opportunism that just comes from the breakdown of society. But yeah, grim stuff. And this is exactly why, you know, we go and we talk about these issues every single day, because this is the stuff that needs to change in order for South Africans to have a more optimistic future. Any final thoughts?
I absolutely endorse that last point. It doesn't help to shy away from these things. We've got to confront them. And the IRR does do this. It's a long history of doing this with lots of alternative ideas, better ways of doing things. We are prepared to talk about it. We encourage other people to do that, to face it. Don't be cynical. There are plenty of reasons to be optimistic, but that optimism must be founded in advancing alternative, better ideas.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. All right. Thank you very much for watching. We hope you found this interesting, and we will be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a great week. The Daily Friend Show and the Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.